Pellerat said, "You'll notice that the fifth one down in the third column, the 19th in order, is inscribed in letters a little larger than the others. The listers seem to have been self-centered enough to give themselves some pride of place. Besides, what does the name read?" "As near as I can make out, it says Melpomenia. It's a name I'm totally unfamiliar with." "Could it represent Earth?" Pellerat shook his head vigorously, but that went unseen inside his helmet. He said, "There are dozens of words used for Earth in the old legends. Gaia is one of them, as you know. So is Terra and Erda and so on. They're all short. I don't know of any long name used for it, or anything even resembling a short version of Melpomenia." "Then we're standing on Melpomenia, and it's not Earth." "Yes. And besides, as I started to say earlier, an even better indication than the larger lettering is that the coordinates of Melpomenia are given as 0, 0, 0, and you would expect coordinates to be referred to one's own planet." "Coordinates?" Trevise sounded dumbfounded. "That list gives the coordinates, too?" "They give three figures for each, and I presume those are coordinates. What else can they be?" Trevise did not answer. He opened a small compartment in the portion of the spacesuit that covered his right thigh and took out a compact device with wire connecting it to the compartment. He put it up to his eyes and carefully focused it on the inscription on the wall, his sheathed fingers making a difficult job out of something that would ordinarily have been a moment's work. "Camera?" asked Pellerat unnecessarily. "It will feed the image directly into the ship's computer," said Trevise. He took several photographs from different angles, then said, "Wait, I've got to get higher. Help me, Janoff." Pellerat clasped his hands together, stirrup fashion, but Trevise shook his head. "That won't support my weight. Get on your hands and knees." Pellerat did so, laboriously. And, as laboriously, Trevise, having tucked the camera into its compartment again, stepped on Pellerat's shoulders, and from them onto the pedestal of the statue. He tried to rock the statue carefully to judge its firmness, then placed his foot on one bent knee and used it as a base for pushing himself upward and catching the armless shoulder. Wedging his toes against some unevenness at the chest, he lifted himself, and finally, after several grunts, managed to sit on the shoulder. To those long dead who had revered the statue and what it represented, what Trevise did would have seemed blasphemy, and Trevise was sufficiently influenced by that thought to try to sit lightly. "You'll fall and hurt yourself," Pellerat called out anxiously. "I'm not going to fall and hurt myself, but you might deafen me." Trevise unslung his camera and focused once more. Several more photographs were taken, and then he replaced the camera yet again and carefully lowered himself till his feet touched the pedestal. He jumped to the ground, and the vibration of his contact was apparently the final push, for the still intact arm crumbled and produced a small heap of rubble at the foot of the statue. It made virtually no noise as it fell. Trevise froze, his first impulse being that of finding a place to hide before the watchman came and caught him. Amazing, he thought afterward, how quickly one relives the days of one's childhood in a situation like that, when you've accidentally broken something that looks important. It lasted only a moment, but it cut deeply. Pellerat's voice was hollow, as befitted one who had witnessed and even abetted an act of vandalism. But he managed to find words of comfort. It's all right, Golan. It was about to come down by itself anyway. He walked over to the pieces on the pedestal and floor, as though he were going to demonstrate the point, reached out for one of the larger fragments, and then said, "Golan, come here." Treviz approached, and Pellerat, pointing at a piece of stone that had clearly been the portion of the arm that had been joined to the shoulder, said, "What is this?" Treviz stared. There was a patch of fuzz, bright green in color. Treviz rubbed it gently with his suited finger. It scraped off without trouble. "It looks a lot like moss," he said. "The life without mind that you mentioned?" "I'm not completely sure how far without mind. Bliss, I imagine, would insist that this had consciousness, too, but she would claim this stone also had it." Pellerat said, "Do you suppose that moss stuff is what's crumbling the rock?" Treviz said, "I wouldn't be surprised if it helped. The world has plenty of sunlight, and it has some water. Half what atmosphere it has is water vapor. The rest is nitrogen and inert gases, just a trace of carbon dioxide, which would lead one to suppose there's no plant life. But it could be that the carbon dioxide is low because it is virtually all incorporated into the rocky crust. Now, if this rock has some carbonate in it, perhaps this moss breaks it down by secreting acid, and then makes use of the carbon dioxide generated. This may be the dominant remaining form of life on this planet."
"Fascinating," said Pellerat.
"Undoubtedly," said Treviz, "but only in a limited way. The coordinates of the spacer worlds are rather more interesting, but what we really want are the coordinates of Earth. If they're not here, they may be elsewhere in the building, or in another building. Come, Janoff."
"But you know," began Pellerat.
"No, no," said Treviz impatiently. "We'll talk later. We've got to see what else, if anything, this building can give us. It's getting warmer." He looked at the small temperature reading on the back of his left glove. "Come, Janoff." They tramped through the rooms, walking as gently as possible. Not because they were making sounds in the ordinary sense, or because there was anyone to hear them, but because they were a little shy of doing further damage through vibration. They kicked up some dust, which moved a short way upward and settled quickly through the thin air, and they left footmarks behind them. Occasionally, in some dim corner, one or the other would silently point out more samples of moss that were growing. There seemed a little comfort in the presence of life, however low in the scale, something that lifted the deadly, suffocating feel of walking through a dead world, especially one in which artifacts all about showed that once, long ago, it had been an elaborately living one. And then Pellerat said, "I think this must be a library." Treviz looked about curiously. There were shelves, and as he looked more narrowly, what the corner of his eye had dismissed as mere ornamentation seemed as though they might well be book films. Gingerly, he reached for one. They were thick and clumsy, and then he realized they were only cases. He fumbled with his thick fingers to open one, and inside he saw several discs. They were thick, too, and seemed brittle, though he did not test that. He said, "Unbelievably primitive."
"Thousands of years old," said Pellerat apologetically, as though defending the old Melpomenians against the accusation of retarded technology.
Treviz pointed to the spine of the film, where there were dim curlicues of the ornate lettering that the ancients had used. "Is this the title? What does it say?" Pellerat studied it.
"I'm not really sure, old man. I think one of the words refers to microscopic life. It's a word for microorganism, perhaps. I suspect these are technical microbiological terms, which I wouldn't understand even in standard galactic."
"Probably,"
said Trevise morosely. And equally probably it wouldn't do us any good even if we could read it. We're not interested in germs. Do me a favor, Janoff. Glance through some of these books and see if there's anything there with an interesting title. While you're doing that, I'll look over these book viewers. Is that what they are? Said Pellerat, wondering. They were squat cubicle structures, topped by a slanted screen and a curved extension at the top that might serve as an elbow rest or a place on which to put an electro notepad, if they had had such on Melpomenia. Trevise said, If this is a library, they must have book viewers of one kind or another, and this seems as though it might suit. He brushed the dust off the screen very gingerly, and was relieved that the screen, whatever it might be made of, did not crumble at his touch. He manipulated the controls lightly, one after another. Nothing happened. He tried another book viewer, then another, with the same negative results. He wasn't surprised. Even if the device were to remain in working order for 20 millennia in a thin atmosphere and was resistant to water vapor, there was still the question of the power source. Stored energy had a way of leaking, no matter what was done to stop it. That was another aspect of the all-embracing, irresistible second law of thermodynamics. Pellerat was behind him. Golan? Yes. I have a book film here. What kind? I think it's a history of spaceflight. Perfect. But it won't do us any good if I can't make this viewer work. His hands clenched in frustration. We could take the film back to the ship. I wouldn't know how to adapt it to our viewer. It wouldn't fit, and our scanning system is sure to be incompatible. But is all that really necessary, Golan? If we... It is really necessary, Janoff. Now, don't interrupt me. I'm trying to decide what to do. I can try adding power to the viewer. Perhaps that is all it needs. Where would you get the power? Well... Trevise drew his weapons, looked at them briefly, then settled his blaster back into its holster. He cracked open his neuronic whip and studied the energy supply level. It was at maximum. Trevise threw himself prone upon the floor and reached behind the viewer. He kept assuming that was what it was, and tried to push it forward. It moved a small way, and he studied what he found in the process. One of those cables had to carry the power supply, and surely it was the one that came out of the wall. There was no obvious plug or joining. How does one deal with an alien and ancient culture where the simplest taken-for-granted matters are made unrecognizable? He pulled gently at the cable, then harder. He turned it one way, then the other. He pressed the wall in the vicinity of the cable, and the cable in the vicinity of the wall. He turned his attention as best he could to the half-hidden back of the viewer, and nothing he could do there worked either. He pressed one hand against the floor to raise himself, and as he stood up, the cable came with him. What he had done that had loosened it, he hadn't the slightest idea. It didn't look broken or torn away. The end seemed quite smooth, and it had left a smooth spot in the wall where it had been attached. Pellerat said softly, Golan, may I... Trevise waved a peremptory arm at the other. Not now, Janoff, please. He was suddenly aware of the green material caking the creases on his left glove. He must have picked up some of the moss behind the viewer and crushed it. His glove had a faint dampness to it, but it dried as he watched, and the greenish stain grew brown. He turned his attention toward the cable, staring at the detached end carefully. Surely there were two small holes there. Wires could enter. He sat on the floor again and opened the power unit of his neuronic quip.
Carefully, he depolarized one of the wires and clicked it loose. He then slowly and delicately inserted it into the hole, pushing it in until it stopped. When he tried gently to withdraw it again, it remained put, as though it had been seized. He suppressed his first impulse to yank it out again by force. He depolarized the other wire and pushed it into the other opening. It was conceivable that that would close the circuit and supply the viewer with power. "Genoff," he said, "you've played about with book films of all kinds. See if you can work out a way of inserting that book into the viewer."
"Is it really necessary?"
"Please, Genoff, you keep trying to ask unnecessary questions. We only have so much time. I don't want to have to wait far into the night for the building to cool off to the point where we can return."
"It must go in this way," said Genoff. "But..."
"Good," said Trevise. "If it's a history of spaceflight, then it will have to begin with Earth, since it was on Earth that spaceflight was invented. Let's see if this thing works now." Pellerette, a little fussily, placed the book film into the obvious receptacle, and then began studying the markings on the various controls for any hint as to direction. Trevise spoke in a low voice while waiting, partly to ease his own tension. "I suppose there must be robots on this world, too, here and there, in reasonable order to all appearances, glistening in the near vacuum. The trouble is, their power supply would long since have been drained, too. And even if repowered, what about their brains? Levers and gears might withstand the millennia, but what about whatever microswitches or subatomic gizmos they had in their brains? They would have to have deteriorated. And even if they had not, what would they know about Earth? What would they..." Pellerette said, "The viewer is working, old chap. See here." In the dim light, the book viewer screen began to flicker. It was only faint, but Trevise turned up the power slightly on his neuronic whip, and it grew brighter. The thin air about them kept the area outside the shafts of sunlight comparatively dim, so that the room was faded and shadowy, and the screen seemed the brighter by contrast. It continued to flicker, with occasional shadows drifting across the screen. "It needs to be focused," said Trevise.
"I know," said Pellerette. "But this seems the best I can do. The film itself must have deteriorated."
The shadows came and went rapidly now, and periodically there seemed something like a faint caricature of print. Then, for a moment, there was sharpness, and it faded again. "Get that back and hold it, Genoff," said Trevise. Pellerette was already trying. He passed it going backward, then again forward, and then got it and held it. Eagerly, Trevise tried to read it, then said in frustration, "Can you make it out, Genoff?"
"Not entirely," said Pellerette, squinting at the screen. "It's about Aurora, I can tell that much. I think it's dealing with the first hyperspatial expedition. The prime outpouring, it says."
He went forward, and it blurred and shadowed again. He said finally,
"All the pieces I can get seem to deal with the spacer worlds, Golan. There's nothing I can find about Earth."
Trevise said bitterly, "No, there wouldn't be. It's all been wiped out on this world as it has on Trentor. Turn the thing off."
"But it doesn't matter,"
began Pellerette, turning it off. "Because we can try other libraries? It will be wiped out there, too. Everywhere. Do you know..." He had looked at Pellerette as he spoke, and now he stared at him with a mixture of horror and revulsion.
"What's wrong with your faceplate?" he asked.
67. Pellerette automatically lifted his gloved hand to his faceplate, and then took it away and looked at it.
What is it? He said, puzzled. Then he looked at Treviz and went on rather squeakily, There's something peculiar about your faceplate, Golan. Treviz looked about automatically for a mirror. There was none, and he would need a light if there were. He muttered, Come into the sunlight, will you? He half-led, half-pulled Pellerat into the shaft of sunlight from the nearest window. He could feel its warmth upon his back, despite the insulating effect of the spacesuit. He said, Look toward the sun, Janov, and close your eyes. It was at once clear what was wrong with the faceplate. There was moss growing luxuriantly where the glass of the faceplate met the metallized fabric of the suit itself. The faceplate was rimmed with green fuzziness, and Treviz knew his own was, too. He brushed a finger of his glove across the moss on Pellerat's faceplate. Some of it came off, the crushed green staining the glove. Even as he watched it glisten in the sunlight, however, it seemed to grow stiffer and drier. He tried again, and this time the moss crackled off. It was turning brown. He brushed the edges of Pellerat's faceplate again, rubbing hard. Do mind, Janov, he said. Then, later, Do I look clean? Good, so do you. Let's go. I don't think there's more to do here. The sun was uncomfortably hot in the deserted, airless city. The stone buildings gleamed brightly, almost achingly. Treviz squinted as he looked at them, and, as far as possible, walked on the shady side of the thoroughfares. He stopped at a crack in one of the building fronts, one wide enough to stick his little finger into, gloved as it was. He did just that, looked at it, muttered, Moss, and deliberately walked to the end of the shadow and held that finger out in the sunlight for a while. He said, Carbon dioxide is the bottleneck. Anywhere they can get carbon dioxide, decaying rock, anywhere, it will grow. We're a good source of carbon dioxide, you know, probably richer than anything else on this nearly dead planet. And I suppose traces of the gas leak out at the boundary of the faceplate. So the moss grows there. Yes. It seemed a long walk back to the ship, much longer and, of course, hotter than the one they had taken at dawn. The ship was still in the shade when they got there, however. That much Treviz had calculated correctly, at least. Pellerat said, Look. Treviz saw. The boundaries of the main lock were outlined in green moss. More leakage, said Pellerat. Of course. Insignificant amounts, I'm sure, but this moss seems to be a better indicator of trace amounts of carbon dioxide than anything I ever heard of. Its spores must be everywhere, and wherever a few molecules of carbon dioxide are to be found, they sprout. He adjusted his radio for ship's wavelength and said, Bliss, can you hear me? Bliss's voice sounded in both sets of ears. Yes. Are you ready to come in? Any luck? We're just outside, said Treviz. But don't open the lock. We'll open it from out here. Repeat, don't open the lock. Why not? Bliss, just do as I ask, will you? We can have a long discussion afterward. Treviz brought out his blaster and carefully lowered its intensity to minimum, then gazed at it uncertainly. He had never used it at minimum. He looked about him. There was nothing suitably fragile to test it on. In sheer desperation, he turned it on the rocky hillside in whose shadow the far star lay. The target didn't turn red hot. Automatically, he felt the spot he had hit. Did it feel warm? He couldn't tell with any degree of certainty through the insulated fabric of his suit. He hesitated again, then thought that the hull of the ship would be as resistant,
within an order of magnitude at any rate, as the hillside. He turned the blaster on the rim of the lock and flicked the contact briefly, holding his breath. Several centimeters of the moss-like growth browned at once. He waved his hand in the vicinity of the browning, and even the mild breeze set up in the thin air in this way sufficed to set the light skeletal remnants that made up the brown material to scattering.
"Does it work?" said Pellerat anxiously.
"Yes, it does," said Trevise. "I turned the blaster into a mild heat ray." He sprayed the heat all around the edge of the lock, and the green vanished at the touch. All of it. He struck the main lock to create a vibration that would knock off what remained, and a brown dust fell to the ground. A dust so fine that it even lingered in the thin atmosphere, buoyed up by wisps of gas.
"I think we can open it now," said Trevise. "I think we can open it now," said Trevise,
and using his wrist controls, he tapped out the emission of the radio wave combination that activated the opening mechanism from inside. The lock gaped and had not opened more than halfway when Trevise said, "Don't dawdle, Janoff. Get inside. Don't wait for the steps. Climb in." Trevise followed, sprayed the rim of the lock with his toned-down blaster. He sprayed the steps, too, once they had lowered. He then signaled the close of the lock and kept on spraying till they were totally enclosed. Trevise said, "We're in the lock, Bliss. We'll stay here a few minutes. Continue to do nothing." Bliss's voice said,
"Give me a hint. Are you all right? How is Pell?"
Pell said, "I'm here, Bliss, and perfectly well. There's nothing to worry about."
"If you say so, Pell. But there'll have to be explanations later. I hope you know that."
"It's a promise," said Trevise, and activated the lock light. The two spacesuited figures faced each other. Trevise said, "We're pumping out all the planetary air we can, so let's just wait till that's done."
"What about the ship air? Are we going to let that in?"
"Not for a while. I'm as anxious to get out of the spacesuit as you are, Janoff. I just want to make sure that we get rid of any spores that have entered with us or upon us."
By the not entirely satisfactory illumination of the lock light, Trevise turned his blaster on the inner meeting of lock and hull, spraying the heat methodically along the floor, up and around, and back to the floor. "Now you, Janoff." Pellerat stirred uneasily, and Trevise said, "You may feel warm. It shouldn't be any worse than that. If it grows uncomfortable, just say so." He played the invisible beam over the faceplate, the edges particularly, then, little by little, over the rest of the spacesuit. He muttered, "Lift your arms, Janoff." Then, "Rest your arms on my shoulder and lift one foot. I've got to do the soles. Now the other. Are you getting too warm?" Pellerat said,
"I'm not exactly bathed in cool breezes, Golan."
"Well then, give me a taste of my own medicine. Go over me."
"I've never held a blaster."
"You must hold it. Grip it so, and with your thumb push that little knob and squeeze the holster tightly." "Right. Now play it over my faceplate." "Move it steadily, Janoff. Don't let it linger in one place too long." "Over the rest of the helmet, then down the cheek and neck." He kept up the directions, and when he had been heated everywhere and was in an uncomfortable perspiration as a result, he took back the blaster and studied the energy level. "More than half gone," he said, and sprayed the interior of the lock methodically, back and forth over the wall, till the blaster was emptied of its charge, having itself heated markedly through its rapid and sustained discharge. He then restored it to its holster. Only then did he signal for entry into the ship. He welcomed the hiss and feel of air coming into the lock as the inner door opened. Its coolness and its convective powers would carry off the warmth of the spacesuit far more quickly than radiation alone would do. It might have been imagination, but he felt the cooling effect at once. Imagination or not, he welcomed that, too. "Off with your suit now, Genoff, and leave it out here in the lock," said Trevise. "If you don't mind," said Pellerat, "a shower is what I would like to have before anything else." "Not before anything else. In fact, before that, and before you can empty your bladder even, I suspect you will have to talk to Bliss." Bliss was waiting for them, of course, and with a look of concern on her face. Behind her, peeping out, was Phelim, with her hands clutching firmly at Bliss's left arm. "What happened?" Bliss asked severely. "What's been going on?" "Guarding against infection," said Trevise dryly, "so I'll be turning on the ultraviolet radiation. Break out the dark glasses. Please don't delay." With ultraviolet added to the wall illumination, Trevise took off his moist garments one by one and shook them out, turning them in one direction and another. "Just a precaution," he said. "You do it too, Genoff. And Bliss, I'll have to peel altogether. If that will make you uncomfortable, step into the next room." Bliss said, "It will neither make me uncomfortable nor embarrass me. I have a good notion of what you look like, and it will surely present me with nothing new." "What infection?" "Just a little something that, given its own way," said Trevise with a deliberate air of indifference, "could do a great damage to humanity, I think." 68. It was all done. The ultraviolet light had done its part. Officially, according to the complex films of information and instructions that had come with the Far Star when Trevise had first gone aboard back on Terminus, the light was there precisely for purposes of disinfection. Trevise suspected, however, that the temptation was always there, and sometimes yielded to use it for developing a fashionable tan for those who were from worlds where tans were fashionable. The light was, however, disinfecting, however used. They took the ship up into space, and Trevise maneuvered it as close to Melpomenia's sun as he might without making them all unpleasantly uncomfortable, turning and twisting the vessel so as to make sure that its entire surface was drenched in ultraviolet. Finally, they rescued the two spacesuits that had been left in the lock and examined them, until even Trevise was satisfied. "All that," said Bliss at last, "for moss. Isn't that what you said it was, Trevise? Moss?"
"I call it moss," said Trevise, "because that's what it reminded me of. I'm not a botanist, however. All I can say is that it's intensely green and can probably make do on very little light energy."
"Why very little?"
"The moss is sensitive to ultraviolet and can't grow or even survive in direct illumination. Its spores are everywhere, and it grows in hidden corners, in cracks and statuary, on the bottom surface of structures, feeding on the energy of scattered photons of light wherever there is a source of carbon dioxide." Bliss said,
"I take it you think they're dangerous."
"They might well be. If some of the spores were clinging to us when we entered, or swirled in with us, they would find illumination in plenty without the harmful ultraviolet. They would find ample water and an unending supply of carbon dioxide."
"Only 0.03% of our atmosphere," said Bliss.
"A great deal to them. And 4% in our exhaled breath. What if spores grew in our nostrils and on our skin? What if they decomposed and destroyed our food? What if they produced toxins that killed us? Even if we labored to kill them, but left some spores alive, they would be enough, when carried to another world by us, to infest it, and from there be carried to other worlds. Who knows what damage they might do?
Bliss shook her head.
Life is not necessarily dangerous because it is different. You are so ready to kill.
That's Gaia speaking, said Trevise.
Of course it is. But I hope I make sense nevertheless. The moss is adapted to the conditions of this world, just as it makes use of light in small quantities, but is killed by large. It makes use of occasional tiny whiffs of carbon dioxide, and may be killed by large amounts. It may not be capable of surviving on any world but Melpomenia.
Would you want me to take a chance on that? Demanded Trevise. Bliss shrugged.
Very well. Don't be defensive. I see your point. Being an isolate, you probably had no choice but to do what you did.
Trevise would have answered, but Phalum's clear, high-pitched voice broke in her own language. Trevise said to Pellerat,
What's she saying?
Pellerat began, What Phalum is saying... Phalum, however, as though remembering a moment too late that her own language was not easily understood, began again.
Was there Jemby there where you were?
The words were pronounced meticulously, and Bliss beamed.
Doesn't she speak Galactic well? And in almost no time.
Trevise said in a low voice, I'll mess it up if I try. But you explain to her, Bliss, that we found no robots on the planet.
I'll explain it, said Pellerat. Come, Phalum.
He placed a gentle arm about the youngster's shoulders.
Come to our room, and I'll get you another book to read.
A book? About Jemby?
Not exactly.
And the door closed behind them.
You know, said Trevise, looking after them impatiently, we waste our time playing nursemaid to that child.
Waste? In what way does it interfere with your search for Earth, Trevise?
In no way. Playing nursemaid establishes communication, however, allays fear, supplies love. Are these achievements nothing?
That's Gaia speaking again.
Yes, said Bliss. Let us be practical, then. We have visited 3 of the old spacer worlds, and we have gained nothing.
Trevise nodded.
True enough. In fact, we have found each one dangerous, haven't we? On Aurora, there were feral dogs. On Solaria, strange and dangerous human beings. On Melpomenia, a threatening moss. Apparently, then, when a world is left to itself, whether it contains human beings or not, it becomes dangerous to the interstellar community.
You can't consider that a general rule.
3 out of 3 certainly seems impressive.
And how does it impress you, Bliss?
I'll tell you. Please listen to me with an open mind. If you have millions of interacting worlds in the galaxy, as is, of course, the actual case, and if each is made up entirely of isolates, as they are, then on each world, human beings are dominant and can force their will on non-human life forms, on the inanimate geological background, and even on each other. The galaxy is, then, a very primitive and fumbling and misfunctioning galaxia, the beginnings of a unit. Do you see what I mean?
I see what you're trying to say, but that doesn't mean I'm going to agree with you when you're done saying it.
Just listen to me. Agree or not as you please, but listen. The only way the galaxy will work is as a proto-galaxia, and the less proto and the more galaxia, the better. The Galactic Empire was an attempt at a strong proto-galaxia, and when it fell apart, times grew rapidly worse, and there was the constant drive to strengthen the proto-galaxia concept. The Foundation Confederation is such an attempt. So was the Mules Empire.
So is the empire the Second Foundation is planning. But even if there were no such empires or confederations, even if the entire galaxy were in turmoil, it would be a connected turmoil, with each world interacting, even if only hostily, with every other. That would in itself be a kind of union, and it would not yet be the worst case. What would be the worst, then? You know the answer to that, Trevise. You've seen it. If a human-inhabited world breaks up completely, is truly isolate, and if it loses all interaction with other human worlds, it develops malignantly. A cancer, then? Yes. Isn't Solaria just that? Its hand is against all worlds, and on it, the hand of each individual is against those of all others. You've seen it. And if human beings disappear altogether, the last trace of discipline goes. The each against each becomes unreasoning, as with the dogs, or as merely an elemental force, as with the moss. You see, I suppose that the closer we are to Galaxia, the better the society. Why, then, stop at anything short of Galaxia? For a while, Trevise stared silently at Bliss. I'm thinking about it. But why this assumption that dosage is a one-way thing, that if a little is good, a lot is better, and all there is best of all? Didn't you yourself point out that it's possible the moss is adapted to very little carbon dioxide so that a plentiful supply might kill it? A human being 2 meters tall is better off than one who is 1 meter tall, but is also better off than one who is 3 meters tall. A mouse isn't better off if it is expanded to the size of an elephant. He wouldn't live. Nor would an elephant be better off reduced to the size of a mouse. There's natural size, a natural complexity, some optimum quality for everything, whether star or atom. And it's certainly true of living things and living societies. I don't say the old galactic empire was ideal, and I can certainly see flaws in the Foundation Confederation. But I'm not prepared to say that because total isolation is bad, total unification is good. The extremes may both be equally horrible, and an old-fashioned galactic empire, however imperfect, may be the best we can do. Bliss shook her head. I wonder if you believe yourself, Trevise. Are you going to argue that a virus and a human being are equally unsatisfactory and wish to settle for something in between, like a slime mold? No. But I might argue that a virus and a superhuman being are equally unsatisfactory and wish to settle for something in between, like an ordinary person. There is, however, no point in arguing. I will have my solution when I find Earth. On Melpomenia, we found the coordinates of 47 other spacer worlds. And you'll visit them all? Every one, if I have to. Risking the dangers on each. Yes, if that's what it takes to find Earth. Pellerat had emerged from the room within which he had left Phalum and seemed about to say something when he was caught up in the rapid-fire exchange between Bliss and Trevise. He stared from one to the other as they spoke in turn. How long would it take? Asked Bliss. However long it takes, said Trevise, and we might find what we need on the next one we visit. Or on none of them. That we cannot know till we search. And now at last Pellerat managed to insert a word. But why look, Golan? We have the answer. Trevise waved an impatient hand in the direction of Pellerat, checked the motion, turned his head and said blankly, What? I said we have the answer. I tried to tell you this on Melpomenia at least 5 times, but you were so wrapped up in what you were doing. What answer do we have? What are you talking about?
About Earth. I think we know where Earth is.
Part 6. Alpha. Chapter 16. The Center of the Worlds. 69.
Trevise stared at Pellerat for a long moment, and with an expression of clear displeasure. Then he said, "Is there something you saw that I did not, and that you did not tell me about?"
"No," answered Pellerat mildly. "You saw it, and, as I just said, I tried to explain, but you were in no mood to listen to me."
"Well, try again."
Bliss said, "Don't bully him, Trevise."
"I'm not bullying him. I'm asking for information. And don't you baby him."
"Please," said Pellerat, "listen to me, will you, and not to each other. Do you remember, Golan, that we discussed early attempts to discover the origin of the human species, Yarif's project? You know, trying to plot the times of settlement of various planets on the assumption that planets would be settled outward from the world of origin in all directions alike. Then, as we moved from newer to older planets, we would approach the world of origin from all directions."
Trevise nodded impatiently. "What I remember is that it didn't work because the dates of settlement were not reliable."
"That's right, old fellow. But the worlds that Yarif was working with were part of the second expansion of the human race. By then, hyperspatial travel was far advanced, and settlement must have grown quite ragged. Leapfrogging very long distances was very simple, and settlement didn't necessarily proceed outward in radial symmetry. That surely added to the problem of unreliable dates of settlement. But just think for a moment, Golan, of the spacer worlds. They were in the first wave of settlement. Hyperspatial travel was less advanced then, and there was probably little or no leapfrogging. Whereas millions of worlds were settled, perhaps chaotically, during the second expansion, only 50 were settled, probably in an orderly manner in the first. Whereas the millions of worlds of the second expansion were settled over a period of 20,000 years, the 50 of the first expansion were settled over a period of a few centuries, almost instantaneously in comparison. Those 50, taken together, should exist in roughly spherical symmetry about the world of origin. We have the coordinates of the 50 worlds. You photographed them, remember, from the statue. Whatever or whoever it is that is destroying information that concerns Earth either overlooked those coordinates or didn't stop to think that they would give us the information we need. All you have to do, Golan, is to adjust the coordinates to allow for the last 20,000 years of stellar motions. Then find the center of the sphere. You'll end up fairly close to Earth's sun, or at least to where it was 20,000 years ago.
Trevise's mouth had fallen slightly open during the recital, and it took a few moments for him to close it after Pellerat was done. He said,
"Now why didn't I think of that?"
"I tried to tell you while we were still on Melpomenia."
"I'm sure you did. I apologize, Janoff, for refusing to listen. The fact is, it didn't occur to me that..."
He paused in embarrassment. Pellerat chuckled quietly.
"That I could have anything of importance to say. I suppose that ordinarily I wouldn't, but this was something in my own field, you see. I am sure that, as a general rule, you'd be perfectly justified in not listening to me."
"Never," said Trevise. "That's not so, Janoff. I feel like a fool, and I well deserve the feeling." My apologies again, and I must now get to the computer.
He and Pellerat walked into the pilot room, and Pellerat, as always, watched with a combination of marveling and incredulity as Trevise's hands settled down upon the desk, and he became what was almost a single-man computer organism.
"I'll have to make certain assumptions, Janoff," said Trevise, rather blank-faced from computer absorption. "I have to assume that the first number is a distance in parsecs, and that the other two numbers are angles in radians, the first being up and down, so to speak, and the other right and left. I have to assume that the use of plus and minus in the case of the angles is galactic standard, and that the 000 mark is Melpomedia's sun."
"That sounds fair enough," said Pellerat.
"Does it? There are six possible ways of arranging the numbers, four possible ways of arranging the signs. Distances may be in light years rather than parsecs, the angles in degrees rather than radians. That's 96 different variations right there. Add to that the point that if the distances are light years, I'm uncertain as to the length of the year used. Add also the fact that I don't know the actual conventions used to measure the angles, from the Melpomenian equator in one case, I suppose. But what's their prime meridian?"
Pellerat frowned. "Now you make it sound hopeless."
"Not hopeless. Aurora and Solaria are included in the list, and I know where they are in space. I'll use the coordinates and see if I can locate them. If I end up in the wrong place, I will adjust the coordinates until they give me the right place, and that will tell me what mistaken assumptions I am making as far as the standards governing the coordinates are concerned. Once my assumptions are corrected, I can look for the center of the sphere."
"With all the possibilities for change, won't it make it difficult to decide what to do?"
"What?" said Trevise. He was increasingly absorbed. Then, when Pellerat repeated the question, he said, "Oh, well, chances are that the coordinates follow the galactic standard, and adjusting for an unknown prime meridian isn't difficult. These systems for locating points in space were worked out long ago, and most astronomers are pretty confident they even antedate interstellar travel. Human beings are very conservative in some ways, and virtually never change numerical conventions once they grow used to them. They even come to mistake them for laws of nature, I think. Which is just as well. For if every world had its own conventions of measurement that changed every century, I honestly think scientific endeavor would stall and come to a permanent stop." He was obviously working while he was talking, for his words came haltingly. And now he muttered, "But quiet now." After that, his face grew furrowed and concentrated, until, after several minutes, he leaned back and drew a long breath. He said quietly, "The conventions hold. I've located Aurora. There's no question about it. See?" Pellerat stared at the field of stars and at the bright one near the center and said,
"Are you sure?"
Trevise said, "My own opinion doesn't matter. The computer is sure. We've visited Aurora, after all. We have its characteristics, its diameter, mass, luminosity, temperature, spectral details, to say nothing of the pattern of neighboring stars. The computer says it's Aurora."
"Then I suppose we must take its word for it."
"Believe me, we must. Let me adjust the view screen and the computer can get to work. It has the 50 sets of coordinates, and it will use them one at a time." Trevise was working on the screen as he spoke. The computer worked in the four dimensions of space-time routinely, but for human inspection, the view screen was rarely needed in more than two dimensions. "Now,
The screen seemed to unfold into a dark volume, as deep as it was tall and broad. Trevise dimmed the room lights almost totally to make the view of Starshine easier to observe. "It will begin now," he whispered. A moment later, a star appeared, then another, then another. The view on the screen shifted with every addition so that all might be included. It was as though space was moving backward from the eye so that a more and more panoramic view could be taken. Combine that with shifts up or down, right or left. Eventually, 50 dots of light appeared, hovering in three-dimensional space. Trevise said, "I would have appreciated a beautiful spherical arrangement, but this looks like the skeleton of a snowball that had been patted into shape in a big hurry out of snow that was too hard and gritty." "Does that ruin everything?" "It introduces some difficulties, but that can't be helped, I suppose. The stars themselves aren't uniformly distributed, and certainly habitable planets aren't. So there are bound to be unevennesses in the establishment of new worlds. The computer will adjust each of those dots to its present position, allowing for its likely motion in the last 20,000 years. Even in that time, it won't mean much of an adjustment. And then fit them all into a best sphere. It will find a spherical surface, in other words, from which the distance of all the dots is a minimum. Then we find the center of the sphere, and Earth should be fairly close to that center. Or so we hope. It won't take long. 70. It didn't. Trevise, who was used to accepting miracles from the computer, found himself astonished at how little time it took. Trevise had instructed the computer to sound a soft reverberating note upon deciding upon the coordinates of the best center. There was no reason for that, except for the satisfaction of hearing it, and knowing that perhaps the search had been ended. The sound came in a matter of minutes, and was like the gentle stroking of a mellow gong. It swelled till they could feel the vibration physically, and then slowly faded. Bliss appeared at the door almost at once. "What's that?" she asked, her eyes big. "An emergency?" Trevise said, "Not at all." Pellerat added eagerly, "We may have located Earth, Bliss. That sound was the computer's way of saying so." She walked into the room. "I might have been warned." Trevise said, "I'm sorry, Bliss. I didn't mean it to be quite that loud." Phelim had followed Bliss into the room and said, "Why was there that sound, Bliss?" "I see she's curious, too," said Trevise. He sat back, feeling drained. The next step was to try the finding on the real galaxy, to focus on the coordinates of the center of the spacer worlds, and see if a G-type star was actually present. Once again, he was reluctant to take the obvious step, unable to make himself put the possible solution to the actual test. "Yes," said Bliss. "Why shouldn't she? She's as human as we are." "Her parent wouldn't have thought so," said Trevise abstractedly. "I worry about the kid. She's bad news." "In what way has she proven so?" demanded Bliss. Trevise spread his arms. "Just a feeling." Bliss gave him a disdainful look and turned to Phelim. "We are trying to locate Earth, Phelim." "What's Earth?" "Another world, but a special one. It's the world our ancestors came from. Do you know what the word ancestors means from your reading, Phelim?"
"Does it mean..."
But the last word was not in Galactic. Pellerat said, That's an archaic word for ancestors, Bliss. Our word forebears is closer to it.